The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Pep's tactical masterclass as City humiliate United for 45 minutes in the Carabao Cup. Is no centre-forwards the answer, or are Manchester United just not as good as their rivals? Honours even in the other semi-final as Iheanacho levels it for Leicester, while Gareth Southgate gets to see which of James Maddison or Jack Grealish will be more unlucky when they're both left out of the next England squad. We'll cover Arsenal's win over Leeds in the FA Cup, which you can now watch on gambling websites. We'll talk to Nicky Bandini about Serie A and Sid Lowe about the Spanish Supercoppa, which is taking place in Saudi Arabia, obviously. There are some angry Everton fans, some iconoclasts in Sweden, and Tinder getting involved in the transfer window. All that, plus your questions, on today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On the panel today, Nick Ames, how are you?
I'm very well, Max, how are you?
I'm tremendous. You've been telling us, and we'll get into detail at some point about this, about how much you love Mikel Arteta.
Great guy, and I'm very jealous of his hair, so that's the main reason.
Is he the footballer? Is it, you know, on the scale of footballers you love, is there anyone higher? Who's at the top of the Ames love list?
Mauricio Tirico.
Not Frank Yallop.
No, but he did score a belter from 35 yards at White Hart Lane once, which I watched as in 7-year-olds. So close.
I'm a big fan of a right-footed left back.
Yeah, me too. That's the main reason, obviously. Yeah.
Hey, Lars Sivertsen.
Hi, Max.
How are you?
I'm feeling good.
Great. You had pasta with a classic tomato sauce for breakfast.
I did. I should stress that's not really the source for me feeling good as such.
Right.
But I went to bed early last night and I woke up early and I feel good.
Wow. And that is a change to your normal.
It really is.
Normal setup. John Bruin, nice to see you.
To see you so soon.
Exactly. Two pods in a week. Are you in the red zone or do you think you'll get through this?
I feel in the red zone, I'll be honest. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, we'll see how far you flag. It's sort of Barry territory, isn't it? And he is quite often in the red zone, let's be honest.
Yes.
Let's start at Old Trafford then. Manchester United 1, Manchester City 3. Lars,
yeah.
What do you think a reasonable, on the balance of the game, what would a reasonable halftime score have been?
12, something like this. No, it wasn't very good, and the first half in particular wasn't very good at all. They looked flummoxed, and I think, again, if you compare the team sheets, on one hand you could say there's no great shame in being played off the park by this Man City team when this is the team you have to put out because this is the team you have. But the really negative thing for United and for Solskjaer and his standing, I guess, is that it did feel earlier in the season that these sort of games against, you know, ball-happy, possession-hungry opponents, they'd kind of found a way of dealing with that by being quite solid, quite compact defensively, hitting them on the break. They were absolutely not able to do that here. They were nowhere near. They couldn't get the basics right. They were beaten to the ball and all of this, and it was bad.
It's interesting you started on the negative, Lars. You're normally quite a positive person, because I thought, John, it was just City being absolutely sensational. Clearly there are two teams in any game, right? But I just thought they were amazing for 45 minutes.
They can be amazing and were amazing. The problem is we are in the business of looking for narrative, storylines, and Manchester United's continuing almost obsolescence as a football force. It was what we were viewing there. Now, here's someone that I'd lionise to you just before Christmas, maybe November sometime, Scott McTominay.
Mm.
They missed him in that game. They missed a midfielder that could lock down the midfield against Manchester City. Whether he would have been enough when Manchester City are playing full flow like that is a different question, of course. That's the thing with City. On their day, I would still back them to be the best team in the country. We just haven't seen it enough this season.
But when we do see it, it's quite joyous, Nick. And they didn't play any centre forwards, which is rare, right? Most times you see a lineup, it has some centre forwards in it. Pep didn't seem to say it was a masterclass afterwards, or he tried to move people away from going, was that this was a masterclass. Maybe he just didn't want to sound really arrogant about it. But he sounded quite mardy after what was quite an amazing performance.
Yeah, that seems to be Pep's default setting nowadays, I think. But they were fantastic, the sort of three false nines or whatever you want to call them, buzzing around. And I think Pep was aware that when you've got two centre-backs like Lindelof and Jones, who aren't necessarily the most switched on, then, you know, sticking a centre-forward, even one as clever as Aguero or Gabriel Jesus, on top of them isn't necessarily the best thing to do. Just render them spinning tops by having guys whirling around them. And I mean, I was doing the player ratings for that game for the paper, and I gave Lindelof a 3, which felt like bullying. I think I've never done that before. I felt like, what's the French newspaper that coats everyone off? L'Equipe, yeah. But to be honest, City were just absolutely all over them. They were totally statuesque, and I think City have played that sort of system before, haven't they? With no striker, so I don't think it was, you know, something that we haven't seen. And I think De Bruyne said afterwards that they cooked up their game specific tactics in about 15 minutes, which I don't know who that says more or less about. But no, they were fantastic. Bernardo Silva unplayable for 45 minutes. I thought Mahrez ran him quite close, actually. But United have... I mean, we could talk about it all day, couldn't we? But they've got to be better than that.
Just on how City did it, Johnny Liu writing, look, it was in effect a 4-4-2 without the two main strikers, or if you preferred a 4-2-4 with Sterling and Mahrez, the advanced wingers, or perhaps a Spanish-style 4-6-0, or if you squinted quite hard, a 4-3-3 with De Bruyne as the false nine. The point was there was no point, no focus, no recognised axis of attack. Just a series of multiple pivots all buffeting gently and randomly against each other like wind chimes. Is that a fair reflection, Lars? But how does it work if you don't play a centre-forward? You have people in that position.
Yeah, you have... you have players who can move around, and you don't give the opponent like a center forward to mark. You're a little bit more flexible in it. I think, as lovely as Johnny Liu's prose is, the word random, I'm not sure I'd add to the mix, though, because it's not random when City play. I mean, they have these patterns that they weave, that they work on very specifically in training, and maybe not, yeah, you go here and I go there, but it's the idea of creating triangles and moving into space and this sort of thing. And if you really watch very closely when they create chances, it isn't random, because players make movements off the ball to free up space for others and this sort of thing. They're just an incredibly well-drilled team. And it's not. It's often it can look like they're playing with freedom, but it isn't necessarily just that. They have certain principles that they stick to.
Do you think we sort of, you know, at this level, are all teams doing this a bit? You know, like on a Saturday afternoon at my clogger level, you almost go before at the start of the game, and you all stand in your slot, and that's where you are for the whole game. Obviously, football is more complex than that.
Well, yes, of course it is, but it's about having a set of principles that you stick to, and a set of ideas of how to create space and how to move to create space for others and this sort of thing. The thing that United is particularly bad at, I guess you'd say.
There's always been that idea that Pep Guardiola doesn't quite like centre-forwards, and that his ideal game would be, his ideal formation would be one without a centre-forward. Well, you're going back nearly 10 years ago when he removed Zlatan Ibrahimovic and played Messi as a centre-forward, which is effective, you've got to say. Towards the end of his time at Barcelona, he seemed to be messing around with the idea of playing as many midfielders in the team as he possibly could. I suppose it speaks to the weakness of Manchester United that he felt he could go into this game and experiment in that way. And the thing is with Pep, I suppose he's drilled those players so well that he can, on occasion, pull off those experiments, whereas another manager with lesser players might struggle with something like that.
I do wonder whether he would have made that selection if McTominay and Harry Maguire had both been available, because between them you could sort of imagine them being savvy enough to lock down that space in front, which was where City pulled into a lot and absolutely thrived. And I think Man United's central midfield, you've got Fred and Pereira, and I'm sorry, it's as weak as anything, much as they they both improved a bit after half time. It was hard not to. But I wonder whether Pep, you know, having seen what United didn't have available that day, thought, yeah, I can give this a go. Why not?
And it's another virtue of playing in that way is that you get an extra man in midfield, right? So when you're making these sort of passing triangles and these creating angles to play each other in, you have an extra man in those areas, and that gives you more options on the ball.
Do you think he saw the fact that Phil Jones was going to play in that game and thought, reach for the Brian Eno album and thought, let's have some fun?
I mean, Phil gets a bad press, doesn't he? Did you give Jones higher rating than Lindelof?
I gave Jones a 4, okay. Lofty heights. But then I spent most of yesterday morning watching that clip of De Bruyne completely twizzling him inside out for the third goal, yeah, wasn't it? And thought I might have been a bit generous.
So Manchester United weren't very good. But they were, as we've said, they were missing Maguire and McTominay. They were missing Pogba as well, Shaw, Martial as well. And we have given Solskjaer some credit recently, you know, for the win at the Etihad, for a good performance, I think, against Spurs as well, when we thought Spurs were good.
Yeah, but that's what I touched on earlier. They had gotten to a point where in these bigger games they could sit back and be compact and hit people on the break. But what's so enormously disappointing is then how poor they were at Arsenal, who you felt were still there for the taking, and how completely off it they were in this game. But you could also play the old game of, like, which player in the United lineup would get into the City team right now? There's probably De Gea, I guess, you'd have over Bravo, but I think that's where it ends, no?
Possibly. Would you get Chris Smalling back? And we've mentioned Lindelof and Jones. I'm not sure what his deal is, but he's playing well in Italy.
I get the impression that Solskjaer and Chris Smalling perhaps don't see eye to eye. Oh, really? So that one doesn't seem to be a way back for that one.
Okay. And now Eddie on reception at The Guardian says it's time for Solskjaer to go. Now Eddie did play for Linfield and Watford before a series of knee injuries. So, you know, he knows his football. Is it time?
No, I it's not time. The time will come. And as is the way with Manchester United, the time will come when Solskjaer has missed a target. Now, the target will be Champions League qualification. And, you know, you could probably tick down the days until he's going to be out of a job. The same happened to David Moyes back in 2014. Louis van Gaal lost his job for ostensibly the same thing in 2016. So miss out on Champions League qualification, it's the end for you. And, you know, you can sell that to your investors on one of those conference calls as the right decision to make.
Thing is, they are staggeringly still in this time.
Yeah, they are. And if they can contrive a repeat of the counter-attacking performance at the Etihad that we referenced a while ago, then maybe they can turn it around. But I think, I don't think it was a masterclass by Oli that won them that game. I think it was a touch of naivety by, like, you know, it's not rocket science to attack those spaces in behind, let them on counter-attack. And I think it's not rocket science either to, on Pep's part, to know how to shut that down, to play with more control, which is what they did the other day. And I think it just takes a 5% improvement from City on that league game for it not to happen again.
Yeah, I think that just the decline of Manchester United over those 6 or 7 years, I think, is most shown by when Pep Guardiola's City turn up at Old Trafford and just start passing around like that in a way that in the Ferguson era only really Guardiola's Barcelona or Real Madrid in the early 2000s did. It's just, you just see how far behind Manchester United are in those games.
And it's so damning as well that at 3-0 they just go, yeah, it's fine, we don't really need to try anymore. It's a two-legged tie as well. Like, at 3-0, there's no sense that we think this might collapse, Man United might come back, we should probably use this superiority and knock a few more past them. Mm. At 3-0, they were like, nah, it's fine. They basically almost like they declared in the second half.
And they got that goal back because of the one aspect that looked in the first 5 or 10 minutes like it might come off them, because I think there was a move in about the 5th minute where James played it into Rashford and he totally burnt past Otamendi, didn't he? And he centred it across and someone cleared. And I think that was the only other time in the entire game that Rashford managed to expose Otamendi, who didn't really know where he was for that goal, put it away. And you think that is another thing City, to be fair, did well. They stopped United from getting into those one-on-ones.
I like the idea of a football team declaring. You know, it's cocky, isn't it? Just, yeah. you know, just waving them in. Just come it's in, fine. Lads. How many years, John, would you give it for Manchester United, if ever, to get back to the top table?
Well, it will be 30 years for Liverpool this year. And previously it took Manchester United 26 years. Now, obviously, they have the finance, though they won't have the finance if they keep dropping out of the Champions League and they suddenly don't become so attractive to noodle partners in Micronesia. There's such a long way back. It's the thing that's said so often by the fans is that while the current regime is in control, there isn't really a way back because of the way that the club is run, essentially as any businesses are, to feed the owners and the shareholders. And the people running the club at the top have proved themselves to be inadequate at buying players, inadequate at choosing managers, inadequate at working with the managers. And until that culture changes, there isn't a way back for Manchester United.
Let's move on. Leicester 1, Villa 1. Leicester had 21 shots to Villa's 3. James Maddison had 8. But, John, it didn't feel like a one-sided game to me at all. Actually, in many ways, I felt Leicester was sort of quite fortunate. I don't know if that's me just misreading it.
I wasn't the only person to think this, and actually, I'll name him, Nick Miller, formerly of this parish, a friend of us all here, tweeted that he thought that how great it was that if you were a Villa fan in the away end, knowing that you'd seen out a famous away victory. Now, he tweeted that a minute before Leicester equalised, sorry about that, Nick, but I agreed with the point that he was making, actually, which was that Villa did look comfortable and Leicester looked ragged. Now, before that game, there was this big thing of how Brendan Rodgers hadn't lost a domestic cup game in 30 matches. The last game he actually lost was the 2015 FA Cup semi-final to Aston Villa, which was a pretty humiliating experience for him. At this point, we have to insert the Scottish football clause. Sorry for all you Fitbar fans out there. Villa, and credit to Dean Smith, were fantastic for all of that game, until maybe towards the end after they conceded the goal. Tyrone Mings, outstanding.
He was amazing, wasn't he? And the thing about Mings as well is just you watch how he talks everybody through a game, and you just... we talk about leaders a lot, and I sometimes think we sort of fall into a really dangerous, cliched world of needing 11 leaders, but he gives off this air of leadership that I don't see from that many other players.
No, he's a hugely impressive character. I mean, we've seen that. I mean, his conduct for England against Bulgaria, and he's a hugely impressive player as well. Someone who's had to wait his turn. But yeah, fantastic in this game. Villa defended well. Jack Grealish was actually playing, I mean, I said it before, playing in that sort of messy role. So you put your best player, essentially, as a withdrawn striker, and he takes it to the opposition while the rest of the team are soaking up Leicester. And, you know, you could build this game as a bit of a James Maddison versus Jack Grealish. Of the two, I would favour Jack Grealish from that game.
Did as someone who was not able to watch the game, did
what was stopping you?
Dinner.
Nick's got a life, you see.
Not true. As someone who wasn't able to watch the game for very important professional reasons, did Leicester miss, in my opinion, one of the top five midfielders in the league, Wilfred Ndidi?
Yes, they did, actually. And I heard Brendan Rodgers talk about that after the game, talking about how Wilfred leads the press, which is one of those modern phrases.
It's him and Rupert Murdoch, isn't it, between them? I thought that deserved more.
I laughed.
Thanks. Now, but you mean you really had to force it, though, yeah, John, didn't you? Had to get in the positions to score the goals.
I'm in the red zone, all right. You know. And so what... He selected Dennis Praet, forgive my pronunciation there, a player who I've not really seen too much of that's impressed me so far this season.
Yes, people seem to call him Dennis Praet, but I wanted to watch him yesterday because I was thinking, there's a player that keeps getting in the Leicester team who I haven't really paid any attention to. And he didn't have a brilliant...
And then he's withdrawn at half-time and you think, oh, I've not noticed him.
Exactly. Yeah. And actually, Roger said he should have started Hamza Chowdhury, who did steal the ball off Douglas Luiz, who was just having a lie-down, wasn't
he? Oh, yeah.
For the Iheanacho goal.
Sometimes you need to take a nap.
Sometimes you do, but that is not the place.
No, of course.
Indeed, he's out for 3 or 4 weeks for Leicester, which could be a problem for them. I think the... Carry on.
I was going to say, yeah, I mean, Chowdhury is one of those players who... probably doesn't get to play as much as you might want, but he's a player who, let's put it this way, I think he was a player, if I'm correct, that put in a fairly nasty tackle for England under-21s over the summer. He likes that side of the game. He's actually very good at that side of the game, except when he makes tackles like that. And he changed the game around for Leicester. There was a definite improvement for them once he came on. And yeah, Iheanacho, again, one of the good things about Brendan this season has been his substitutions, his use actually of Iheanacho. And that was, as big a mistake as it was, that was one hell of a finish when he got in the position.
He did. And you know, we've said how good Tyrone Mings is, and he did. Mings knew exactly what he was going to do. You know what Iheanacho is going to do, right? Yeah. It's the lesser Arjen Robben, you know, get it onto his left foot and hammer it.
You mentioned this. It didn't seem like a game where Villa conceded all these shots, but I wonder if this is something Villa do regularly. Because I've not watched all of their games, but I've watched some of them this season. I always feel like Villa look fine, like they're not a bad team, they're fine. But then you look at the number, like they've conceded by far the most expected goals against in the league, but by a bit of a distance. And if you don't like the expected goals, they concede more shots against them per game than anyone else either. Mm. So maybe, like, defensively, they're just sort of stealthily bad without anyone really noticing.
I suppose I didn't feel like their keeper had to, and maybe I'm misremembering again, I don't remember him making a string of great saves. I think I don't know if your special stats machine can tell you how far out Villa were. I mean, Leicester were. And I suppose the point is you can concede shots if they're all from 35 yards and be okay.
Well, yeah, but that's very much the idea of XG, is that that's meant to sort of allow for that. So not looking at this game in particular, but overall, Villa have conceded a lot of good chances as well this season.
It's good that I understand XG even 3 years late.
Last, tell us... if I may take over the show.
By all means. Last tries on a regular basis. So.
I keep thinking you should have a sort of craft beer thing, sort of what is John Bruin or something.
Oh, God, Jesus.
Do you know what? The first time someone cracked that joke to me would have been about 1981. So there you go. Nyland, the goalkeeper.
Yes. Oh, yeah, Nyland.
Tell me about him.
He's... I've sat next to him on a bus. That's exciting.
Okay. Where was the bus going from?
From the team hotel to the place they were training.
It wasn't the number 38.
No. It was he's had some injury problems. He had a good career in Norway, playing for Hud and Molde, and then he went to Germany and didn't maybe fully work out quite as well as he was hoping. Bit of a surprise when he got a move to Villa, to be honest. And he's got some caps for Norway. I think he's not a bad goalkeeper. And I think it's exciting to see him get a chance, because goalkeepers are funny like that. You can sort of go under the radar and not have an amazing career. But if you get a chance somewhere, you know, if the place is yours to lose, you can have a few good games and you can establish yourself.
He looked very comfortable, actually. Mm. He also looked quite scared. His sort of general face is quite a scared face.
I mean, I'm trying to be polite, because I think, as far as I understand, he's a nice guy. He's a compatriot of mine. He's had, when he's played for Villa, he hasn't fully convinced in the past, I have to be honest. I mean, that's been the truth. I think if you search up his name on an Aston Villa forum, I think you might find some angry posts. He hasn't always been very great for them. But
saw him and them at Villa on Saturday, and I was quietly impressed with his handling, and he made one very good save, I think, from Knockett. But he also, and he seemed to have a sort of Joe Hart-esque ability to get beaten from range a little bit too often.
Oh, at Fulham, yeah.
And talking of which, they seem to be tracked by Pepe Reina, who
really his only job is to celebrate on buses for tournaments that he hasn't won.
Now, I was, I talked about this elsewhere, but I spent a lot of Christmas watching Gary Neville's Soccer Box.
Right.
And I got the impression that the Man United players didn't think much of Pepe Reina.
Fair enough.
I'm not even sure that Jamie Carragher thought that much of him as a goalkeeper. He was effective for Liverpool, but I never thought he was great. And at 37, I mean, all right, they are, Villa are desperate. is that who they should be turning to?
What's the better use of your time? Spending Christmas watching Gary Neville's Soccer Box, or spending your afternoons on Aston Villa forums checking out their views of their second goalkeepers? Who knows? Just a quick one on Grealish. I mean, David said, is Jack Grealish the player that Jack Wilshere was supposed to become? And Xander says, when will the England selectors, like it's the cricket team, stop being cowards and pick Jack Grealish? He basically single-handedly drew that game with Leicester yesterday. He's such a tremendous footballer, and he's a joy to watch as well, isn't he?
Yeah, if you want to compare Grealish and Wilshere, I'd say it works 50% in that he's an excellent carrier of the ball and good upper body strength, like Wilshere had maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago before he became a bit part player, shall we say. But I think Wilshere probably more of a player in deep positions who can make that line-breaking pass or line-breaking surge. But Grealish, when you get him in those pockets between midfield and defence, he is fast becoming, you know, him and Maddison, I think, are probably the two most exciting players at it, at getting the ball in that pocket and driving and then playing that little pass.
And given the way that England play, is there a, you know, it doesn't naturally have a 10, do they? You know, it's sort of more Liverpool like, I would suggest. You know, you've got your front three and then you play slightly different midfield. Is there a way of getting him in?
Not of a moment.
No,
I don't think.
It's funny, you've got those players you mentioned, Maddison and Grealish, and it's almost like the 1970s where they couldn't find a place in the team for Alan Hudson, Tony Curry, all these sort of, you know, playmakers.
Or building the team around Hoddle or Letizia.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and England just don't do that. They tend to build the team around central defenders and strikers.
I hear what you're saying. I do wonder for England, I think you can put him in the three in midfield as long as the two next to him are grafters, basically. I mean, you'll need Henderson and an extra guy who runs around a lot. It could maybe work, but it does limit you a little bit. I think Grealish is an interesting sort of case study of, there's a thing to be said for young players not making a big move to a big club too soon, because there was the sort of sliding doors moment when he was close to a move to Spurs. You know, whispers that Pochettino didn't fancy him that much. I mean, if he'd have gone there when he did, I'm not sure he would have developed as much. I mean, he stayed at Villa. He's played a lot of games for them. He's played a lot of football for a guy his age. He's got something like 250 games, or that might be including reserves and things, but I'm just looking at it here. Anyway, he's played a lot of football for a guy his age, and he's matured very well.
It's a really good point that I was when I was doing my preparation for Villa versus Fulham versus Villa on Saturday, I was going back over the report I had written from when they played in the playoff final a couple of years before, which Fulham won. And I'd written afterwards that, you know, Grealish walked out of Wembley and it was probably his last game. They're going to have to send him on and move on for his career and that kind of thing, which seemed a logical idea then. But to be fair, for various different reasons, I think he stayed there for another year in the Championship, absolutely ran it whenever I was watching him, got into that groove, that bit of confidence where you're loving your football and when you know things are coming off you, which you need as a player who sort of was getting towards that top bracket at that sort of age. And now he's sort of taking that sort of momentum on, and it's really thriving off it.
I should just very quickly edit myself. He hasn't played 250 games. That very much included games for Notts County and the Aston Villa under-23s.
Well, he's
played
something
like, played 160 anyway for Villa, which is pretty good for a guy his age.
He's been around a while because, you know, I mentioned the last game that Brendan lost, a competitive cup tie. Jack Grealish was actually playing in that for Aston Villa and actually ran that game as a very skinny, reedy player, and now has filled out. He's a real specimen. Like, he's a very strong guy.
Yeah. As we mentioned on Monday, Wesley and Tom Heaton both suffering season-ending injuries at the weekend. As you've mentioned, Villa looking to bring in Pepe Reina. Danny Drinkwater is coming on loan for the rest of the season as well. And that'll do for part one. We'll start part two at the Emirates. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Live shows for you, January the 20th at the Sanus Benny Theatre in Brighton. Me, Barry, Ellis and Nicky. So that's Monday week. Come along, please. There are four tickets left for Monday, the 27th of January, which is me, Barry, Wilson and Nicky. There are it's a sellout the Tuesday at the Liberty Hall in Dublin. Me, Barry, Lars and Johnny Lou. Are you claiming some sort of credit?
Absolutely not.
Because for selling more tickets.
I'm pretty sure it was sold out before I was announced. So, I mean, I can't claim any credit for that. But it was so much fun last time. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, I really am. And we won't talk about what you were offered at 3 in the morning in that pub by the pinball machine. March the 9th and 10th in Scotland. We're halfway sold in Glasgow on the 9th and on the 10th. Over halfway, Edinburgh. Lars, you're there for two. Ellis joining in Edinburgh. Glasgow's final guest, TBC. Right, to the Emirates. Ryan says, how many points are Leeds going to win the 2020-2021 Premier League title by after their 1-0 defeat to Arsenal in the Cup? John Bruin.
I fear they might not be in the Premier League.
It's interesting. I mean, they were so good. Was this game a sort of microcosm of Leeds United in that they were absolutely sensational? And then they burnt themselves out a bit, or have I just fallen into the narrative trap?
No, that's the metaphor I was reaching for. Yeah, we saw how Leeds have fallen in love with Bielsa. The football that they played, how great they are to watch. But yeah, they pegged out a bit.
Barney Ronay writing, the point of the FA Cup is to get Marcelo Bielsa's Leeds United to the Emirates Stadium and stick them on primetime TV. That ought to do it for now. Best of all, Bielsa's team with that rare thing in elite sport, a source of constant surprise.
There'll be, just to reply to John's controversial point, they'll be fine. I think they need a backup striker for Bamford, quite obviously, because it didn't work out with Eddie Nketiah, who was on loan from Arsenal. But I think we kind of saw, didn't we, on Monday night, that Patrick Bamford is one of those players who's maybe in that never region between Championship and Premier League. So, yes, exactly. Yeah. Too good for one, or more than good enough for one, not good enough for the other.
Do you think Huckabee? I think Darren Huckabee had some good Premier League moment.
Robbie Earnshaw.
I think at first he was, but once he dropped down with Norwich and came up with Norwich, he wasn't quite at that level.
Cameron Jerome.
Brilliant player in the second tier, though.
Cameron Jerome is a very good shout for that. Mm-hmm.
But Leeds in general, I don't think it can be overstated what a job Bielsa has done there, given that he picked up a squad 18 months ago, and there was a lot of players there who, like, yeah, all right, fine, all right, in the Championship, like Dallas and players like that. And he got them almost straight away into an absolutely smoothly, slickly oiled unit who played the game exactly how he wanted. Now, they did burn out a bit last season, and they tanked it, obviously, in the playoffs, but it's not happened yet this season. I don't think it's going to happen. For that 45 minutes at the Emirates, they were mesmerising. And I'll caveat that by saying that I think Arsenal had decided that they were playing for Unai Emery again for some reason. A lot of what Leeds did well did stem from Arsenal conceding possession quite cheaply from the back or in midfield. And they deserve the rocket that Arteta gave them at halftime. But I think I got the impression that how the game panned out was for two reasons. Arsenal improving, and then when they did go ahead, I think it was patently obvious that Leeds didn't need the replay for probably the reasons that we're mentioning.
They down tools.
Didn't say that.
Okay.
Just said they didn't need it.
If Leeds, you know, stay where they are and they do come up, do you think they could surprise the Premier League like Sheffield United, or do you think they won't surprise us as much if they do well because we're expecting them to do well? Do you see what I mean?
I don't think they'll be quite as big a surprise, because I think it's fair to say that the host broadcaster of the Championship shows Leeds as often as is possible due to the fact that they are the best supported team in the Championship. Whether that makes them easy to play against is a slightly different matter. I think Bielsa, actually, if he sees out this season and takes them up in the next year, That would be the longest he's been at a club since being at, I think, ever. Even at Newell's Old Boys, he didn't last quite as long. He did 2 years at Athletic Bilbao. And actually, I wrote about this in the paper over the weekend. He's got quite a precedent to go up against, because the previous two managers to take Leeds up, Don Revy, or is it Revy? I've never known that. He took 5 years to win the league, and Leeds went straight up in the early 60s and became one of the best teams in the country. Hal Wilkinson did it in 2 years and won the league title, the final ever First Division title. That's a hell of a... that's something to live up to. Now, I wrote this and saying I didn't think it would be that possible. Some Leeds fans tell me that there is Qatari investment.
Oh, good.
Yeah, which always, you know, gladdens the heart that might come into the club. One Leeds United fan was telling me that they could be the next Manchester City. So watch that space if you really dare.
I think one reason why they will, assuming they go up, be absolutely fine is simply that they are so well coached. And I was with on Monday night another mutual friend of ours, Miguel Delaney from The Independent. And
was he tweeting Manchester City fans?
Very much so.
Liverpool fans.
Liverpool now. Fair enough.
He took time out from doing that for a few minutes to discuss before Arteta's press conference afterwards and Bielsa's press conference. The fact that they are simply so well coached, and if you think about this Premier League season, we're seeing teams rewarded who, for being wonderfully drilled, even if they might not have the best players. You can see Leicester are a fantastic example. Sheffield United are maybe the example.
Wolves as well.
Wolves too. They're playing a slightly different way, a bit more pragmatic maybe. But yeah, Burnley have been for a long time, and I think still are, even if they're sliding a bit now. And I think we're in a time now in the Premier League where there's so much upheaval and movement between players and coaches, and no one really, you know, not too many teams have a long-term plan, inverted commas, and stick to it, that if you've got a plan and a way of drilling your team and you hone it over a few years, like Bielsa seems to be at Leeds, you've got a hell of a chance.
By all accounts, Arteta used his hairdryer at half-time. Fascinated by the Arteta hairdryer, because it must be so... it can't blow any hair anywhere. Do you think it's like those big hats they put on?
I think his hair... I have a theory that you can actually detach it, like all of it.
Like a Lego man.
And you just put it in the microwave or something.
Fair enough. That's how he uses his hairdryer. The fourth round draw is it's not spurned out many fascinating games. There's obviously the famous West Derby, as West Ham play West Brom. City home to Fulham. Liverpool go to Bristol City or Shrewsbury. Spurs or Middlesbrough go to Southampton. Coventry could play Birmingham, which is potentially interesting, given that Coventry play at Birmingham.
Who's the home team in that tie?
It's Bristol Rovers or Coventry versus Birmingham City. So Coventry will be at home. Birmingham, there'll be a lot made of Birmingham being in the away dressing room at St Andrews, won't there? On the FA Cup, David Conn in today's paper with this story about 7 UK betting websites live streaming FA Cup matches as part of a TV and media rights deal struck by the FA that runs until 2024, despite the governing body having announced an end to all sponsorships with gambling companies in 2017. They signed this deal before that, and the deal is with IMG. Before the decision was taken to sever sponsorships with betting companies, the governing body said it will review the sale of betting rights to FA Cup matches before the rights deals are renewed for the 2024-25 season. And I guess, I mean, this is similar to horse racing, right? If you bet on a horse race, you can then click watch race on the gambling website. But given the prevalence of bookmakers, it might be a good idea for the FA to try and change this, does anyone think? Or at least review it when they can review it.
I think this practice has been around for a while. I've never watched an FA Cup game on a betting site, I have to say.
I mean, there are enough of them on television.
Yeah, but you can watch. You can watch them if you really want to. Mm. I think the reason this story came to light is because the FA delayed their games by a minute over the weekend, and it was a mental health campaign. Now, there is a link between problem gambling and mental health, so the accusation is of hypocrisy.
It is difficult, the fact that the gambling industry bankrolls so many parts of football, sponsors so many football shirts, plays a huge part in commercial broadcasting, TV and radio, that it is almost impossible to separate, and, you know, even talking personally, to separate yourself from both things.
Yeah, like even yesterday, a couple of very eloquently argued articles in certain publications on what we've just been talking about had at the bottom adverts for gambling firms. So, you know, it's a very tricky thing to unpick, as you say, and I think it has to be unpicked. I think people are a lot more aware of that now, but it's not going to be simple.
All right, let's move to Serie A. We can talk to Nicky Bandini about what's going on over there. Nicky, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Very good. You are running to Highbury and Islington Tube Station. This is an exciting live action Serie A chat. Right, so both Juve and Inter won. Inter are still top, winning 3-1 at Napoli. How impressive was that win?
Oh, hugely impressive. They haven't won away to Napoli in 23 years. So genuinely something of a statement, something of a pivotal point in the season, you could say, for Antonio Conte as well, because actually both of his predecessors, Spalletti and Mancini, both did have times when they had Inter top of the table around this time of year in the winter, weren't managed to sustain results. So for him to get that result against a team that is someone who Inter haven't been able to beat recently, I think it's a hugely significant moment.
Do you think they'll keep pace with Juve? I mean, everyone is sort of desperate for a title race in every league. We don't have one in the UK, obviously. Do you think that Conte can keep this going?
I think I do, to be honest, yes. There's still another very big game coming up this weekend against Atalanta, which to me feels huge. Atalanta coming off consecutive 5-0 wins, so you couldn't get them more informed. Giampiero Gasperini, their manager, was formerly at Inter and discarded too quickly. So he has a bit of a chip on his shoulder whenever he goes back there as well. So Inter, of course, the one game they have lost the season was against Juventus. So you lose a head-to-head tiebreaker. And also, there's that question of whether or not they can do it in the very, very biggest game, especially when they went out of the Champions League as well. But winning the league, you don't always have to win the big games. If you can be this consistent, if you can always win the games you're supposed to win, I suppose, you know, Bonatti, they did win a big game as well. Sorry, I'm a bit out of breath because I'm running.
I'm enjoying this. It's like interviewing someone on a treadmill. I mean, this is what everyone should do in January, right? It's excellent for fitness. We should all be on step machines while we do the pods. All right, I won't keep you too long then, Nicky. Juve went in at the break against Calgary 0-0. Then Ronaldo scored a hat-trick and it ended 4-0. Did Sarri do anything special at halftime?
I don't think so. I think Calgary somewhat imploded because they had played a pretty decent first half, but Clavan plays this ridiculous ball across the edge of his own box, and then you suddenly have Cristiano Ronaldo having the chance to jump on the ball against a 19-year-old centre back who was making his debut. So it was a game that sort of turned a bit on that moment, although I also would say Ronaldo, who of course had a very indifferent September and October with a lot of talk about his knee injury and perhaps not being fully fit. I think he is actually starting to look much sharper, much quicker, much more like, I guess, the player that Juventus hoped he would be and that he was in patches last season. So that's a big difference, I would say, more than any tactical change in this game.
And finally, as you approach the bend for the final straight, Nicky, Andy says...
I can see the station.
This is so exciting. Andy says, are Lazio the most underrated team in Europe at the moment? 9 wins in a row. What's got into them?
Yeah, I mean, I've been having this argument with some people recently where a lot of people still don't want to consider them part of the title race. I think, you know, you're a team that is, as you say, 9 consecutive wins. They beat Juventus twice in the space of 4-9 and both times deserved it between the league and the Supercoppa. Simone Inzaghi is doing an incredible job. I think there is definitely a fragility to them that you wouldn't see perhaps with Inter and Juventus because, you know, you're very reliant on Ciro Immobile's goals. You're very reliant on the incredible form that Luis Alberto has been in. But they are so good at the moment. And Simone Inzaghi has crafted this team that really very much draws the best out of those players' talents. He's someone who has looked at what he has and developed a style of playing, a counter-attacking style of playing that really works for the players that he has. And yeah, I believe in this team, actually. I don't necessarily think they're going to win the title just because the bar is so high with what Juventus and Inter do. But then again, look, it's only a few years ago at this time of year when everyone was looking at Leicester and saying, can they really sustain it? I don't see why Lazio can't sustain it. The question is just whether or not, bearing in mind they are, even though it's not a lot, 3 points behind, whether or not they can sustain it even better than Inter and Juventus can.
Nikki, always safe to take a bottle of water on the tube, especially after extreme exercise. Thanks for your time.
No probs.
Nikki Bandini there. See you in Brighton for the live show. Nikki Bandini there. Running for a train. Action-packed. How exciting that was. That'll do for part two. We'll start part three with presumably a more sedentary Sid Lowe. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain with Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm tremendous. So the Supercopa is taking place this week in Saudi Arabia. First time it's been expanded to contain more than two teams. The first time it's been played outside of Spain, and ticket sales have been abysmal. Real Madrid sold, 700 tickets for last night's win over Valencia. Valencia just 26. Fair say, Sid, not been much buy-in from Spanish fans for these games.
No, but I mean, that's the key point here, is that those figures are the ones of fans coming from Spain. So actually Real Madrid's number's quite high because they sold quite a lot of tickets to fans in the Middle East. But in terms of people actually travelling, they reckoned that it was around 100 from Real Madrid, of which 83 or so were family members and so on. Around about 17 went in a supporters club. I think the figure was, this is from El País, I think the figure was 35 Barcelona fans, around about 50 Atletico fans, and 26 from Valencia. But as I say, This is a game played in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia, so not many fans are going to travel. The response locally was probably pretty underwhelming as well, actually. The stadium, there was at least 20,000 empty seats, which I think came as a surprise, not least because they'd said that they thought this was going to be sold out. They said that tonight's game, Atletico Madrid-Barcelona, was sold out, and this game had only, and I quite like that use of the word, only 10,000 tickets left the day before the game, but as it turned out, around about 22,000 tickets not occupied.
I know we spoke about it when this was announced, but I mean, I can't quite remember, so I'm sure some listeners can't. Has there been an outcry in Spain about this?
Yeah, I mean, look, on numerous different levels, and obviously, look, there's lots of different ways of dealing with it. One, of course, is the basic fact of moving this competition, which was once the season curtain raiser, like the Community Shield is in England, or whatever the Community Shield's called these days, between the Cup winners and the League winners. It used to be a two games, head-to-head. Last year, for the first time, it was taken out of Spain because they couldn't find the dates. And I must admit, I feel like this is the world upside down. They couldn't find the dates to play two games because Barcelona had their lucrative pre-season tours. So if you like, the pre-season tour took precedence over what is a competition, albeit a competition that's kind of semi-friendly anyway. So they took last year as a one-off game to Morocco, and that, of course, opened the doors. So then you get the question, about shifting the competition to four, moving it to January, putting it on a weekend when there's no league games, but there's a whole load of cup games, which in theory you were really promoting this year and making the cup important again. Then, of course, you get the question about whether it should be taken out of Spain at all. And then the next layer is, well, if it is going to be taken out of Spain, why Saudi Arabia? Now, obviously, we all know the answer to that because there's a hell of a lot of money for this. It's 120 million over a three-year contract. But that has created a little bit of a backlash, possibly not a kind of a great fury. But for example, when this was put up to the TV companies to bid for, the state broadcaster TVE said they were not going to bid for it. And they were not going to bid for it because they didn't want to contribute to what they described as the whitewashing of the regime, particularly on questions of gender equality. So they kind of pulled out. The Federation was furious about that and accused them of effectively trying to torpedo the whole bid. Because, of course, if one TV company pulls out, all the others can get it much, much cheaper. There wasn't a TV deal until about 4 weeks ago, I think. So, I mean, it happened really, really late, although that's, to be honest, that's fairly normal in Spain. And so there has been a bit of a backlash. There's been questions about equality. But what the Spanish Federation did was, I suppose, to engage with that old debate that there's always been about sanctions. And they said, well, look, in a country where there are things happening that you don't like, you can take the choice to just block and not go, or you can use football as a tool to open up. Now, I must admit, most people did laugh when the president of the Federation described this as the supercropper of equality. But he did say that through this, we force the Saudi officials to say women can go to all of these games. Mm-hmm. They can go to all these games in the same areas of the stadium as men. And he believes, or he has claimed that he believes, that this is a tool for, if you like, a process of opening up.
On the pitch, Real Madrid won last night. Toni Kroos scoring directly from a corner. Normally, goals from direct from corners look like pure luck. This looked like pure skill to me.
Yeah, entirely deliberate. I mean, you see it, and the Jaume Domenech, the Valencia goalkeeper, is talking to one of his defenders. Apologies, I can't remember who exactly it is. And he's 5 or 6 yards off his line, and you suddenly see the footage of him and the defender going, "Oh Christ!" and turning and running back towards the goal. He gets there in time. I think he can still save it, but he tries to punch it with both hands. But it's entirely deliberate. He's seen that the keeper's off his line and gone for it. And given how well Cruz delivers from set plays and from corners anyway, yeah, absolutely deliberate. That said, I think a better response from the goalkeeper and it wouldn't have gone in.
Barca Atleti tonight, how seriously are they taking this competition?
Well, look, this is the question that kind of overarches everything, or maybe it's the less important question, but this has always been seen as the competition that's most like a friendly, or the friendly that's most like a competition. In other words, it's not that important, and it never was anyway, although, you know, stadiums filled and fans went and they wanted to win. And everybody has been saying, yeah, we want to win, we're not just going here for a bit of a laugh. But yesterday did feel a bit like a pre-season kind of tournament or a testimonial. In part, of course, that's because of the way that fans respond in the stadium, the way the atmosphere builds or doesn't, and so on. And Valverde, the Barcelona manager yesterday, was very critical of this. He said he didn't like this format. He said he preferred it before, that it was the way that it was supposed to be. But, you know, now that they're there, they'll try. The one question I suppose is, if you're Barcelona, would you rather not get to the final and get back to Spain quickly than get to the final and lose it? Now, obviously, you would prefer to win it, but I do wonder if there's a little bit of prioritisation there.
On Barca, reports that Arturo Vidal is set to leave this month, either going to Inter or Manchester United. He scored 6 in the league this season. Why would he want to leave? Why would they want him to leave?
Well, they would want him to leave because they want to reduce the salary problems that they've got. They would also like to generate some money if they possibly could. But also, perhaps most importantly, his agents and or his lawyers have demanded, I think it's €2.5 million from Barcelona in unpaid bonuses from last year. Barcelona say that this isn't the case. And it's quite amusing, really, because you've got this club situation in which this guy has effectively threatened to take us to court. And you've got the manager saying, well, yeah, but the football's a separate issue. The manager would like him to stay. I think there are people who see him as not being a kind of a Barcelona player, doesn't really fit in the identity of the club. And this is a club, of course, that's obsessed with its sense of identity, its sense of being. But actually, he's performing pretty well, albeit more often off the bench than as a starter.
Question from Lafondra to finish, Sid. I haven't heard you call Sid in a while. I don't think it's Adam Lafondra, by the way, but he says, please ask him how Estella is. Maybe mention something about the Super Cup or something, but mostly Estella.
Yeah, I think Estella is far more important than the Spanish Super Cup, and particularly a Spanish Super Cup being played in Saudi Arabia. Estella is fine, fortunately. I think I told you before Christmas about her problem eating a Christmas cake, which was very nearly disastrous, but she's absolutely fine.
Excellent. Full recovery.
Yes.
Marvellous. Sid, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure. Cheerio.
Sid Lowe out in Spain there. Premier League fixtures, everybody. On Friday, Sheffield United, West Ham. On Saturday, the early kickoff is Palace, Arsenal. You're off to the Arteta press conference later, Nick. You must be very excited.
Very excited.
You like Arteta.
I like him a lot.
The 3 o'clock games, Chelsea, Burnley, Everton, Brighton. This is from Kelston. How would the pod members react to a mob of angry listeners storming the studio, demanding answers for recent poor performances and a clear out of dead wood from the lineup? Who would you sacrifice to appease the fans?
To be fair, that's very similar to the live shows.
It's true. So, I mean, this stems from Marcel Brands holding face-to-face talks with angry fans at Finch Farm on Monday following their FA Cup defeat to Liverpool. A small group of fans arrived to confront the squad, but the squad were having a day off, which is a disappointment. But Marcel Brands, fair play to him, met with supporters, listened to their complaints.
To be fair, I think that's pretty much Marcel Brands' most telling contribution to Everton since being at the club. I think we're still at the point where we're wondering what he's there for, aren't we? But now we know. Executive security guard.
I suspect he might also be wondering what he's there for if the Athletic's coverage of Everton matters are to be believed. It seems to be there are a lot of cooks involved with the decision-making process, and the sporting director perhaps doesn't have the authority that a sporting director should have.
I wonder whether the mob of fans were just trying to make Ancelotti feel welcome, given that it's the sort of thing that probably happened after one bad result for Napoli, you know. but in a way, like, with the obvious caveat that, you know, taking it further and sending the lads in to to bash people up is not anything that anyone of us would condone. I quite like the idea of fans being active and passionate and going there in a peaceful way, wanting to find out what is going on, because so many Premier League stadiums now, and I'd include Goodison Park in that, are pretty quiet. People vent online. There's not, you don't necessarily get that fan activism, which when channeled correctly can be very effective and useful. So while I don't condone threats or violence or anything like that, I think it can be quite healthy.
Yeah, and I like the idea of a character from the club other than the manager interacting with the fans and explaining what's happening, because it's very easy for everyone in the club to kind of hide behind the manager's press conferences and says that's how we communicate with the world. Now, Brands might be a bad example, because like I said,
who do you prefer, the mascot?
No, but you don't get the impression that he's actually had a chance to mould the club the way a sporting director really should. But either way, I think it's very positive that someone in that kind of position engages with the fans.
I think Lars is right. You think back to the 80s and 90s, that club chairman did tend to speak on the record quite a lot more than you do now. Well, I mean, obviously a lot of the owners are overseas or choose to sit in the background, but there's an alarming amount of clubs among the elite, actually, whose owners don't even speak to the media. So if you're a fan scrabbling around for answers and your only vessel for that is a manager who, in the case of Carlo Ancelotti, has been there a matter of days, then, you know, Marcel Brands has done a decent job there.
Leicester Southampton, Leicester 9-0 up from the first leg there. Manchester United play Norwich, Wolves Newcastle. Spurs Liverpool on Saturday is the late kickoff on the telly. Nick, you want to pay homage to Sadio Mane?
Yeah, he's just been named the African Footballer of the Year. So congratulations to him. Obviously, he I think got it ahead of Mahrez and Salah. And I think it's massively deserved. I think we'd all probably agree he's in the top 3 to 5 forwards in the world at the moment. And I think it shows how far he's come. It's very well documented that he comes from a very modest background of a village called Bambali in the south of Senegal, and had to work his way up from there in quite testing circumstances. So I think his is a very good example of how you can come from there and be someone. And I think African football has got many, many problems. It's not really got a great international team at the moment. There's the domestic leagues are falling apart. There's a lot of questions about player movement and player trafficking and lots of very shady stuff like that. But I think he is an absolute poster boy for what can be done and what can be done in the right way. And just for player he is now too. I was with an associate of mine who has coached against him at an international level a couple of days ago, and we were talking about Mane, and he said to me that, you know, what do you tell your players? Do you tell them to get tight and he'll spin you? Do you tell them to sit off a bit and he'll dart past you? And when you're playing against him, certainly at international level, where, okay, the teams are probably a bit more modest than your Man Cities and Chelsea's and stuff, he is now so fast and so quick and so strong, and he makes the right decision almost every time, that he's literally unplayable.
Unless, of course, you're Serge Aurier, we will see on Saturday.
It's an obvious point, but we worry for Spurs there, particularly since with Sissoko injured, and Ndombele, I think, is a doubt as well. I don't. Harry Winks, there's some question marks over how fit he is, and Eric Dier not in amazing form. I mean, playing Liverpool is bad news at the best of times. Playing Liverpool without any kind of midfield doesn't seem very good either.
Yeah, while Dingo says, with Spurs players dropping like flies, results not going Mourinho's way, do you think we'll see the complete collapse of the humble Moo persona after the Liverpool game?
I thought we'd seen that already.
We had. On Sunday, Bournemouth, Watford and Villa, Man City. Also, Cardiff, Swansea at midday in the Championship on Sunday. Just a statement from Alex Horn. Not that one, I presume. Not so much a question. Any chance of a hello to the Plymouth Argyle fans making the trip to Carlisle this weekend? Hello, you are what keeps football going, aren't you? Credit to you. Glenn Whelan news. New Hearts manager Daniel Stendel has released Glenn Whelan 4 months into a 1-year deal. Glenn has hit out. Things were being said about me that I didn't fancy it. I was laying down tools. No way that was the case. He's speaking to the Irish Independent. When the new manager came in, the first person he spoke to was me. He was already having a bit of a go. My form was good for the last few months, but the manager came in and wanted to show his power, show the other players that he's the boss, he's the main man. I do feel let down. The way my name is out there now, it feels like I've been thrown under a bus. He says he found out on Christmas Day via a player's WhatsApp group that he was not in the squad for the Boxing Day defeat by Hibs, and that Stendel refused to discuss why it had dropped him.
He's done that to a couple of senior players, Stendel. I think he's had exactly the same effect on Christoph Berre, who's a very long-serving, you know, well, over two spells defender there. And I think Berre said the other day that he got married on the, I think it was on the Friday, and then on the Sunday, he had a message from Stendel saying, no, mate, we don't want you anymore. Oh. And he's the captain, and he's now got a train with the kids. So I think Stendel is ruffling a few people there.
Shades of Marquis Smith, who the story is that he sacked Mark Riley from the Fall on his wedding day. So, yeah, maybe Stendel is a big fan of Marquis Smith.
There's a bit of the Trevor Francis, but it's my birthday there as well, isn't there?
Every silver lining has a cloud, right? Yes. Bradford have recalled striker Owen Doyle from his season-long loan at Swindon. He's the top scorer in the Football League, 23 goals in 22 games. Swindon are top of the league, 6 points and three places above Bradford. A month ago, Owen said this about his parent club, Bradford. I don't think I suit them. They don't suit me, and this is where I want to be, Swindon. It's a season-long loan. It was made clear to me at the start of the season. I want to be here. I'm not being nasty or anything. I hope Bradford go up as well. I just hope I'm doing it with Swindon and they're doing it off their own back. So welcome back to Bradford for Owen. Some transfer gossip. Chances of this happening, good idea, bad idea. Ademola Lookman, Leipzig to Newcastle, Lars.
A good idea for whom?
Well, I didn't think anyone would question. It's a good idea for everyone.
I mean, he's not playing, and he really does need to play. I mean, as a guy who has shown in flashes that there's exciting stuff in him when he plays regularly, it would be good to see him get some football. And Newcastle, whatever else you say about them, like, if you can get him and Almiron and Alain Saint-Maximin running at people at the same time, that's something I'd like to watch, I guess.
Hopefully one of them with the ball.
Well, that makes it more exciting,
or it's just
sure.
Really like a war, isn't it?
Yeah.
Christophe Piatek, Milan to Spurs.
I mean, I wouldn't. So it's an odd one because he was obviously red hot for Genoa, and he's one of those strikers who he doesn't do a lot outside the box, but if you get the ball into the box a lot, he can put it into the net quite often. And so as an option for Spurs, maybe if they can get a good deal financially, but I think I wouldn't be too hard on him for not doing well for Milan. Milan haven't been a great place recently. I wouldn't be super excited about it.
Wilfried Zaha, Spurs or Chelsea, John?
I think it's not the story that Chelsea have given up on Zaha.
Oh, okay.
He's changed agent, hasn't he?
Who's he gone to? Pini's
Zahavi.
Zahavi,
yeah,
that's
yeah,
it.
Who is the daddy of the super agents.
Is he above Raiola in the super agent
age
club?
Age-wise.
Well, he's been around longer. He's the first of his kind, okay. I suppose you would say, and remains a powerful operator. I get the feeling that Zaha will be at Crystal Palace for the next 5 years, and we will be talking about him every transfer window, and the likes of myself will be writing the rumour mill with another mention of 30-year-old Wilf Zaha. The truth is that the price at which Crystal Palace are willing to sell is not one that other clubs are willing to pay.
What about Rabiot, Juve to Everton, Lars?
That would be funny because when he left PSG, he was linked to Spurs, and it was let known that Spurs was kind of beneath him. He wasn't into that. So having gone to Juve and not played at all and sort of slinking off to Everton would be kind of funny.
The Fernandes currently in the transfer news is Jedson Fernandes, Benfica to lots of people.
To West Ham
West
or Chelsea.
Ham.
Yeah.
The latest was that might not be happening for West Ham, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, and at Chelsea. Okay. Now, we mentioned him before, actually. Victor Lindelof was one of these players. Every January, there is a player from Portuguese football who is floated around, and the prices involved seem to be above what his talent might actually be, and that appears to be one of those. The other one is Bruno Fernandes.
He's good.
He's good, but I didn't actually think he existed for quite a while because...
Are you laughing at my insight there, Lars? I watched him in the Nations League.
I'm going to go with yes.
I watched the Nations League, well, yeah. And he was tremendous in that.
I was laughing, that's right, because I remember you being so excited about him.
Well, that's it. The same, actually. I hadn't seen much of him till then and thought he was a good player, but he's, again, one of those players that floats around and the price seems to climb and climb and climb to the point where he's never going to go anywhere and remains at Sporting Lisbon. What's the other guy called? William Carvalho? Is he still at Sporting Lisbon?
No, he's gone to Betis.
Finally.
Mm-hmm. Mark says, unless you're saying he's just gone round to Betis for a scone
Betis
and a cup of
tea room in Harrogate.
A scone and a cup of tea. Mark says, how would Lars recommend they protect Zlatan's statue once it's repaired? It's been cut down again.
Yep.
And poor old Zlatan, right?
But listen, I don't condone vandalism, obviously, but I think with Zlatan, I mean, so much of his appeal was that he was this sort of anti-establishment, sort of rebellious figure. And then over the years, he's become pure establishment, right? He has all these brands he's involved with. And he then, just shortly after having a statue unveiled in his hometown, he invests in a competitor saying, we're going to be the best in Scandinavia. You can't be surprised if your whole shtick is that you're a rebel, you're an outsider, you're anti-establishment, and you then prove yourself to be every bit as corporate as everyone else, that a lot of the people who used to like you no longer likes you. That's just kind of how it goes. And I think the statue will be continued to be vandalised.
Thank you to Jim for sending in this news. Apparently a new Dundalk signing was leaked because a female fan came across him on Tinder before the club had announced it. I don't care what you say, the League of Ireland is the greatest sporting competition on earth. Someone called Chino, who comes from the University of Illinois team UIC Flames, who play their trade in the Intercollegiate Horizon League. I haven't seen it confirmed yet, but yes, he came on Tinder and it said Chino 22 or 23 and it said player for FC Dundalk and it's a man playing football.
So he'd arrived at the club, they booked him into the travel lodge.
And he was straight on Tinder.
Straight on Tinder. Mm.
He told me he wanted to stick around long enough to make 500 matches, apparently.
Hang on, who did that joke before this pod? Was that you again?
No, I do not reheat my old material for the purposes of this podcast.
But I'm sure someone else did that joke when we weren't on
air. I absolutely reheat my material, but I didn't do that joke.
I plead guilty to having rehearsed that joke when we were having chit-chat over coffee, Max.
Anyway, great gag, Nick Ames. Glenn says, following the Harry Meghan news, should the royal family give it Big Sam until the end of the Queen's reign? To be fair, I would absolutely love them to say, since Harry and Meghan have gone, we're getting in Sam Allardyce. That could only be good news for all of us. Ed says, do you do your beans on the hob or the microwave? John?
I did them just yesterday, the hob.
Lars?
Don't do the beans.
Nick?
Rarely do the beans, but when I do, it's for hob.
I'm a hob man. Finally, an email from Layla Parser, who says, the Natural History Museum runs a Wildlife Photography of the Year exhibition. Every year. It's a really good one, actually. I like it. I once bumped into Damien Duff there, which was a surprise. Anyway, it really was.
Again, if you made some sort of Max Rushton random sentence generator, that would be right in there.
Anyway, one of the winning photos this year, and one of my favourites of the exhibition, was a precious sleeping baby seal. For Christmas, my boyfriend gave me a huge print of the sleeping seal. With that in mind, I've decided to affectionately name him Lars.
Wow.
In homage to my favourite Guardian Weekly guest. Not counting the demigod that is Barry Glendenning, and with Philippe Auclair closely behind. No mention, John, Nick, of you, I'm afraid. I'm sure this is not how Lars saw his celebrity status manifesting itself, but I hope he is flattered nonetheless.
I'm enormously excited about that.
Marvellous.
I like a sea mammal.
Thank you, Layla. If you could get various photos of every one of the podders, that would be greatly appreciated for fairness. John, thanks so much. Two games in a week. You must be shattered.
Red zone thoroughly entered into.
Lars, always a pleasure.
It was fun, Max.
Nick, thank you.
Thank you. I'm off to rehearse my one-liners for next time.
Right, that'll do. We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.